Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
No new taxes. That's the GOP line, right? Kind of depends on what the definition of tax is, though. Financial regulation is big on the show today. And, wait for it, the Greek debt crisis is not over yet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 21st of July. Great to have you here. I'm going to run a name by you, give a little wave or something if it means anything to you. Here goes. Grover Norquist. No real reason for you to know of him unless you're a policy geek. Norquist is, it's fair to say, an anti-tax crusader, an amazingly effective anti-tax crusader. He's got 95% of Republicans in Congress to promise no tax increases. Period. Full stop. But then yesterday, he said this to the editorial board at the Washington Post about the Bush-era tax cuts.
Not continuing a tax cut is not technically a tax increase.
So... right? That was seen, not unreasonably, as an opening to a possible solution to the debt ceiling talks. It was, however, just the start of today's political drama. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the story.
Raise your right hand. I, fill in the blank, oppose any and all efforts to increase the marginal income tax rates, yada yada, that's the Norquist pledge. Question is, if Republican negotiators let tax cuts expire and tax rates go back to a higher level, do they break the pledge? Norquist said technically no, and dealmakers saw an opening, a softening from an ideologue, until Norquist said this on cable TV today.
Americans for Tax Reform would oppose any effort to weaken, reduce, or not continue the 2001-2003 Bush tax cuts.
Okay, whoa, what's going on?
Well, Grover just learned he should never meet with the Washington Post editorial board.
Republican lobbyist Kenneth Keyes is a veteran of Washington tax battles. He thinks Norquist said something he didn't mean.
There's a great line from Nixon, not that I'm trying to compare Grover to Nixon, but I know that you think you understand what I said, but I don't think you understand that what I said is not what I meant.
Certainly not a signal to Republicans to compromise. There's consensus Norquist is not that kind of guy. Who is he? Tom Mann at the Brookings Institution says he descends from a lineage of economic ideologues.
He took an idea, sort of supply-side economics, Reagan tax cutting, and came up with the idea of a pledge, and he is associated with one thing, and that's the tax pledge.
Mann says the power of that pledge is unchanged, whatever Norquist said or meant. Here's tax policy analyst Clint Stretch at Deloitte.
I think what we saw today was that the pledge has taken on a life that may be greater than Mr. Norquist himself.
The upshot, he says, Republicans, the ones who actually vote, remain firm on the tax issue. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The new healthcare law is, in fits and starts, rejiggering the healthcare industry, but the industry isn't wasting any time rejiggering itself. There was another gigantic healthcare merger today. Two of the biggest pharmacy benefits managers, Medco and Express Scripts, are going to get together and create the biggest company of its kind. That news left us with two questions. What will the $30 billion deal mean for consumers? And what the heck is a pharmacy benefits manager anyway? From our health desk at the BOHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner has the what and the why now.
Pharmacy benefits managers act as middlemen between insurance companies and drug makers and retail pharmacies. The PBM can impact costs in a couple of ways. First, by negotiating drug prices.
If a PBM is able to say we're representing twice as many million lives as we represented previously, then they would have more leverage with that pharmaceutical manufacturer.
Michael Manilakis is a professor at Wingate University School of Pharmacy. He says PBMs also cut costs by collecting data on the prescribing habits of thousands of doctors.
One of the things that PBMs are able to do is turn that data into valuable information to help them to say, here's an opportunity to improve a prescribing practice to make it more cost efficient.
By rewarding doctors for prescribing more generics or using that data to shorten the list of drugs they'll pay for, if this merger goes through, it will give Express Scripts and Medco control of one-third of the market.
The question comes, how do they choose to use that strength?
Jack Hoadley is a research professor at the Health Policy Institute of Georgetown University. He says a giant PBM might have less incentive to pass on those savings to consumers. Barack Richman researches antitrust and healthcare policy at Duke Law School. He says as antitrust regulators scrutinize this deal, they'll be taking into account how the industry has shifted since healthcare reform. Hospital systems are joining forces, teaming up with doctor groups, while insurance companies and pharmacies are exploring ways to cut out the middleman.
And it is possible that Medco and Express Scripts will make a good case that given the changing environment, this is really a necessary move to take.
The question for policymakers will be, is what's necessary for Medco and Express Scripts actually a good deal for the rest of us? In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
We're going to hear more about this later in the broadcast, but it was 1 year ago this very day that President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. Actually, putting Dodd-Frank into effect, though, is stuck in a morass of furious lobbying and political maneuvering. Today's case in point being the insurance giant MetLife. The company's looking to sell its banking division and so perhaps avoid being Dodd-Franked. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich explains.
To borrow a line from Steve Martin, it's time to get small. The bigger you are, the more likely you are to get tagged under Dodd-Frank as a systemically important financial institution. These are the kind of too-big-to-fail companies that will get extra special attention from federal regulators. Banking consultant Bert Ely says MetLife would rather not be part of that club.
So they're trying to, you know, have as low a profile as possible. And one of the ways to do it is to dump any deposit-taking institution.
MetLife says it wants to sell off MetLife Bank to avoid being, quote, governed by regulations written for banking institutions, code word Dodd-Frank. And they're not the first insurance company to do this. Allstate did. Ely says the Hartford just sold its bank in May, a bank it had bought mainly to qualify for federal bailout funds.
That's one of the interesting ironies of it. You know, they're basically getting out while they can.
Companies deemed systemically important financial institutions might have to take on less risk and hold more money in reserve. And Ely says insurance companies prefer their comfortable world of state regulation to Dodd-Frank. But wait a minute. Wasn't AIG an insurance company that turned out to be pretty systemically important when the crisis hit?
That's where the definition of systemically important becomes an issue.
Andrew Winton is the chair of banking and finance at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. He doubts insurers can get off the hook that easily.
They may think that if they spin off the banking units, they would no longer have that designation. But I don't think it's going to be clear-cut, and a lot of it's going to end up being at the regulator's discretion.
So until the Dodd-Frank regime is up and running, MetLife, Allstate, and the Hartford are just hedging their bets, exactly what you'd expect from the insurance industry. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Corporate profits and promising news from the continent helped Wall Street today. Details, numbers, the whole smash when we get there. If I knew how to say thank you in Greek right here, I would. Wall Street got a nice little bump today, courtesy of the Eurozone. Huddling for yet another emergency summit in Brussels this morning, European leaders have hatched yet another plan to save Athens from itself and perhaps protect the euro in the process. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the line from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
All right, so it feels like we've been doing Greek debt for, I don't know, ever, and frankly, the details are a little fuzzy. What's in the news today?
Greece will get a second bailout. That's the headline. Europe and the IMF will lend it an extra $155 billion. That's on top of the $160 billion they've already had. And most significantly, there'll be some debt relief. The repayment term for existing EU rescue loans will be doubled to at least 15 years. The interest rate will be cut in half, which technically sounds a lot like a default, albeit a a partial, selective, temporary default.
Explore that term for just a second. Selective default. It sounds like that's a bad thing, but everybody's okay with it?
Well, we'll wait and see whether they're okay with it. I mean, this was the reason. I mean, this goes to the heart of the disagreement between France and Germany, because the Germans were insisting that there should be some pain for private investors, that it shouldn't be just the taxpayers, and particularly the German taxpayers, who would suffer as a result of, as they see it, Greek fecklessness. they wanted to see the banks that bought Greek government debt take a hit. Now, it's not clear whether the banks are going to take much of a hit, because under this deal, we're told it will be voluntary. But as far as any discounts they take will be voluntary, but as far as the rescue loans are concerned that they've already had from the EU and the IMF, the terms are being rewritten. And some people say that is a default.
Can we say now, Stephen, that our long national Greek debt nightmare is over with and we're not going to have to do more of these stories?
No, I don't think so. The markets liked the look of this deal today. They jumped with relief. An agreement is obviously better than no agreement, and this deal may well take the pressure off the Eurozone bond markets and off the euro itself for a while. But the deal doesn't address the fundamental problem, the fundamental flaw in the whole euro project. The fact that you've got 17 different economies using the same currency with the same interest rate, but all running their own different public spending plans. Many analysts say for the long-term stability of the euro, the eurozone is going to have to integrate a lot more. It's going to have to become much more like a United States of Europe with central control over public spending and issuing a eurozone bond backed by the whole group. That's going to be fantastically unpopular in some countries, though, especially Germany.
Let me ask you the self-centered question here, Stephen. One of the reasons that American debt and American interest rates have remained so low is that we look really good compared to the Europeans, right? Do we now look relatively worse that Europe is mending, Greece is mending?
In the short term, perhaps, yes. The hedge funds may be looking around for something else to pick on, some other government bond to kick around. But in the medium to longer term, since this deal doesn't address the fundamental problems with the eurozone, it seems unlikely that there's going to be a major shift and that everyone's going to say the euro is the currency of choice. We can forget about the US dollar.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London with the latest on the not yet over Greek debt story. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Kai.
Coming up, oh, if only.
If big U.S. banks had more capital, they could have absorbed more losses without there being a threat of bankruptcy.
Gee, how can we make that happen? But first, let's do the numbers. A scorcher of a day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials notched another triple-digit gain. The blue chips rose 152 points, 1.2%. Closed at 12,724. The NASDAQ added 20 points, 0.7%, finished at 2834. The S&P 500 up 17 points, about 1.3%, ended things at 1,343. We told you about that blockbuster deal between two companies that manage pharmacy benefits. Medco Health Solutions feverishly traded up 14% on the news that Express Scripts is going to buy it. Express Scripts gained 5.3% today. Data showed today that weekly unemployment claims increased. So did shares in a company that supplies temporary accounting and IT workers. Fresh off a tripling of its quarterly profit, Robert Half International. Shares jumped 15% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on mass layoffs for June. Follow the White House on Twitter. President Obama participates in a White House tweet-up at the University of Maryland. And Comic-Con continues in San Diego. Tomorrow's lineup includes Lego Star Wars, Famous Monsters of Filmland, Girls Gone Genre, and the Science of Zombies. How possible is a zombie virus? I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As we mentioned earlier, this is a big day if you're the regulatory type, the one-year anniversary of the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. It's also opening day for what may well turn out to be that bill's most controversial provision, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So how does one go about building an agency that's disliked, if not actively loathed, by many in Congress and most in the financial world? Marketplace's John Dimsdale got a sneak peek inside.
The new Financial Protection Bureau has been setting up headquarters in a nondescript square building in downtown Washington, just one block from the K Street lobbyists the new consumer watchdogs will be doing battle with in the near future. Inside, with opening day just hours away, the computers and copy machines are kept busy. The cramped cubicles are gray and ordinary, even Spartan. They house a couple hundred workers so far. My tour guide was Associate Director Raj Dante, who took me to a conference room that's awaiting the arrival of a dozen or so new hires.
And as you'll see, it has been completely cannibalized for incoming staff who are transferring from other agencies. For example, this is a very senior economist from the FDIC who's joining us. And this is her office. And
it's basically bare desks and a chair, no bookshelf, no file cabinet.
Yeah, there are dorm rooms that look better than this.
But the Financial Protection Bureau also has four regional offices, from San Francisco to New York, employing a total of 400 with a $500 million budget. Congressional Republicans are raising questions about what they call lavish salaries, but Date says the Bureau needs employees who know their way around bank financial statements.
We have people on staff today whose other alternatives within the private sector are, and I am not exaggerating, 5 times, 10 times, or 20 times the level of compensation that they are able to command here.
Just last week, before the House Oversight Committee, the woman who came up with the idea of a powerful consumer bureau, Elizabeth Warren, defended the expense.
We need a budget because these are very large and powerful financial institutions who hire armies of lawyers to design financial products that can't be read by ordinary American families. We need some pushback. We're the voice on behalf of the customer, of the American families.
While Republicans aim to trim the Bureau's power and budget, surprisingly, the bank industry is keeping its powder dry. Scott Talbot with the Financial Services Roundtable says he and his lobbyists have already been working with the new industry watchdogs.
We've met with most of them, and you know, we haven't met a bad apple, if you will. We haven't seen a bad hire in terms of the intellectual capacity to do the job. And so we may disagree on philosophical grounds with different employees, but intellectually speaking, they're all solid hires.
The CFPB starts without a director. Elizabeth Warren has proven to be too controversial. Earlier this week, President Obama nominated another aggressive consumer advocate, Richard Cordray, to take over. But Senate Republicans say they'll reject all nominees until the administration accepts changes that would weaken the power of the director. The Bureau will eventually write and enforce new rules for non-bank companies like payday lenders and check-cashing companies, but those regulations will have to wait until Congress and the President agree on a new director. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The day it was signed a year ago, the Dodd-Frank bill was plus or minus 800 pages long. Plenty, a reasonable person would think, to regulate almost anything. Problem is, the thing had to get past Congress. So less actually was more, because it didn't spell out all the specific regulations banks and financial firms would have to follow. Dodd-Frank actually got signed. But now, the thing's even longer, because the rules are very slowly being written. We asked Marketplace's David Gura to explain how the sausage is made.
For most of us, a cushion is something we sit on. For a bank, it's a bundle of money kept in reserve. If the bank loses money on some crazy investment, that cushion allows it to pay its bills, and it lets customers withdraw money as usual. Simon Johnson is a professor at MIT. He used to be the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. He says the financial crisis showed us the big banks' cushions weren't big enough.
If big U.S. banks had had more capital, they could have absorbed more losses without there being a threat of bankruptcy, and that would have made the entire system much more stable.
In other words, plumper cushions make for softer landings. Dodd-Frank orders banks to keep more cash in reserve, but it doesn't give details. So over the past 6 months, rulemakers have been hard at work deciding just how plump the bank's cushions should be and what they should be stuffed with. But just how do they decide?
I think it's a black box, honestly. Exactly the basis on which the regulators make their decisions is in many cases not fully transparent.
Notice the plural there. The capital requirement rule is being written by not just one, but three agencies. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Federal Reserve Board. None of them would talk to me. Charles Taylor, who directs the Pew Financial Reform Project, was a lot more helpful. He told me each regulator started by posting a draft version of the rule online late last year.
Industry, academic, and other interested parties provide comments on the intent and the form of the rule, and then it's revised.
That's an open invitation to banks, lobbyists, and private citizens to write in and comment on the proposal. The rule attracted 16 letters. That's about average for a rule that's not a hot-button consumer issue. Dennis Kelleher runs a nonprofit called Better Markets, which supports stronger capital requirements. Since Dodd-Frank was passed, he's written or co-written more than 50 comment letters on a range of issues.
We will then follow it up by talking to the staff. We will go in for a meeting. We will meet with staff and or commissioners and or the chairman, depending upon who has an interest in this. And we make ourselves available to respond to what other people have to say.
Teams of lawyers and lobbyists representing trade associations and financial firms formed long lines outside the rulemakers' offices to make their cases. The stakes were high for the financial industry. They argued the U.S. would lose business to other countries, that their costs would go up, and it'd be tougher for them to lend to folks like you and me. In June, a frustrated Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan Chase's CEO, confronted Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke at a banking conference in Atlanta.
Now we're told there are going to be even higher capital requirements, so-called SIFI charges and G-SIFI charges, et cetera, and we know there are 300 rules coming. Has anyone bothered to study the cumulative effect of all these things?
That cumulative effect was just one of the factors regulators have taken into account in nearly 12 months of back and forth with lobbyists. Washington is a pretty adversarial place these days, so I was surprised by what Charles Taylor of the Pew Project had to say about the rulemaking process. He thinks it's been relatively open, and so far, there haven't been many big turf wars.
One of the hallmarks of the aftermath of the 2008 crisis has been the level of dialogue and coordination. That's true both inside the United States amongst the financial regulatory agencies at the federal level in particular, and also internationally.
Today, 1 year after Dodd-Frank became law, regulators are putting the final stitches into the capital requirements cushion. The rule takes effect later this month. But there are 385 rules in all. So here in Washington, we'll see those comment letters, those long lines of lobbyists, again and again and again. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Over a year ago, a crowd of people stormed the home of Bank of America executive Gregory Baer, chanting, "Bank of America, bad for America."
Commentator and Vanity Fair staff writer Bethany McLean.
Bank of America was not the only target of people's rage. There were also bus tours of AIG executives' homes, protests against Goldman Sachs, and much more. "Will we stop?" chanted the protesters at Baer's home that spring day. "No," they answered. It's not like the banks have changed their ways. Last fall, the news broke that the big banks had been foreclosing on people's homes without following the proper process. And yet, the loud outbursts do seem to have stopped. Where has the rage gone? One theory is that the protests didn't seem to accomplish much. Take regulation. Banks are still lobbying heavily against new regulations. They don't want to hold more capital. And the stock market has soared. Banks have been producing profits and paying big bonuses again. The battle seems to have been lost. The rage against the banks seems to have been replaced by a deep fear about the state of the United States. Unemployment is rising again, and there are justifiable worries about the country's debt burden. People are angrier at the politicians than they are at the bankers. In any event, there's a great irony at work. Regulators are poised to impose higher capital requirements on banks, and that will likely crimp their profits. So the lobbying hasn't paid off entirely. Profits are falling for other reasons, too. There are fears of a debt crisis in Europe. And banks won't earn as much when consumers use their debit cards. Those fees have gone down. Almost every Wall Street firm is planning another round of layoffs. In other words, there's little evidence that the banks are treating consumers any better. But they are feeling the pain where it hurts them the most, their bottom lines.
Bethany McLean is the co-author with Jonah Serra of a book about the roots of the financial crisis. It's called All the Devils Are Here. If you've got some thoughts to share, send them along, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, perhaps the biggest trade in the markets today, definitely the most symbolic, was the 98,000 shares of Chrysler that went for $560 million. With it, the United States government and American taxpayers officially got out of the car business. The Treasury Department sold its last stake in Chrysler today to Fiat, which gives the Italian carmaker a 53.5% stake in the company. Most of the rest of it is owned by the United Auto Workers, which will, in theory, unload that chunk when Chrysler goes public again sometime probably in the next year, maybe 2 years. All right, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. Today, the Dow rose 152 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ up 20.7%. The S&P 500 gained 17 points, 1.3%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on The Big Show, the newest social network has businesses saying, oh man, another one?
They're fearing the social media ninja that's going to be knocking on their door saying, I've got a Google Plus strategy for you.
I don't know. I'd sign up for that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for it tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.